So good evening. This is, I don't know what class, the 10th or something class in this series. Again, in this class, we're working with Chapter 9, and we've made it so far up to, I think, around verse 53, and we'll actually go over 53 again. So what we've seen so far in this chapter is Shantideva beginning to set out the position of the Prasangika Madhyamika school, the middle way consequence school, beginning with kind of setting out the two truths. So we talked a bit about how the two truths are defined in this school, and then going through a bunch of refutations on the basis of even just establishing the two truths. So there were many different points of view, as we know from those of you who did the study in the tenets, the philosophical systems that the Buddha taught, know that there are many different points of view that the Buddha gave. And so Shantideva felt it was necessary to refute a lot of those. So we've gone through several of these refutations, some of the points of view of the Chittamatra, mind-only school, as well as some of the views that are held by the Hinayana schools, the Vaibhashika and Satrantika schools. So the previous sections that we were in had to do with needing to establish then that this wisdom that realizes emptiness according to the middle way consequence school was essential to attaining liberation and essential to attaining Buddhahood. So those were the sections that immediately preceded this. So we went into some discussion of that idea that we require this emptiness, the realization of emptiness according to this school, in order to remove the afflictions completely, remove all the afflictive obscurations, those things that keep us from attaining liberation. But then in this last verse that we looked at prior to this section, verse 52, which is on page 240 of your text, we also looked at the fact that this is necessary for attaining Buddhahood as well. So in some of the lower schools, as we talked about last time, they say that there's actually two different realizations that are needed, actually in all the schools beneath Prasangika Madhyamika. They say that there is a realization, well, actually in the Hinayana schools, that's not true. Okay. The Mahayana schools basically are holding, the other schools are holding that when you realize one particular view of selflessness, which is only the selflessness of persons, particularly that persons lack some self-sufficient, substantial existence, that will get you liberation. But if you want to attain Buddhahood, you have to realize a selflessness of phenomena as well. And so basically, in those schools, there's two different realizations that are needed. Whether you're searching for liberation or whether you're searching for omniscience, you have a separate means to attain that. When we get to the Prasangika Madhyamika school, they say this is not how we posit it. We posit basically that the realization of emptiness, the lack of a self or of an inherently existent self for both persons and all other phenomena, is what's required in order to attain both liberation and enlightenment, complete enlightenment of Buddhahood. So there's none of this delineation of two different views of selflessness, one for liberation and one for enlightenment. So we're going to move into a bit more of a detailed discussion then of what these various conceptions are shortly. We have one more section that we just began last time, which is this third section of this response around the wisdom realizing emptiness being necessary. And this last section, we just look at the advice that Shantideva is giving in terms of then you need to put effort into realizing emptiness. So just after this, we're going to actually go into the extensive explanation of all the reasonings that prove emptiness. So we're very close to the meat of the chapter, if you will. The real, detailed looking at the reasonings that establish emptiness. And so that will be something we'll hopefully get into in a bit tonight. So any questions about where we're at in this text now then, in chapter 9? So why don't we start with reading together on page 240, verse 53. In that case, it is not correct to repudiate the side of emptiness. Therefore, without entertaining any doubts, one should meditate on emptiness. So this was a fairly basic verse. There was some commentary. Again, if we go to the commentary on this, the commentary on verse 53 begins on page 241. Again, I apologize that this text wasn't put together with the commentary on each verse immediately preceding or following it. But that first paragraph that starts with therefore and ends with the word impossible, that's on verse 53. So let's just take a look at this again, and I want to go over one more time this these various objects. I've got a little bit more clarity to it this week, so I did want to go over that. We will get into some of these discussions more when we get to the LORIC, Awareness and Knowers, course of the basic program. But what it says here on page 241, it says, therefore, in the case of what we explained earlier, meaning that what we just talked about in terms of emptiness being required to attain liberation, it is not correct to repudiate the side of emptiness, because the reasoning that will be explained below, which we're just about to get into, will also damage that. So in other words, any views that are held contrary, that you don't need to realize emptiness, will be damaged by the reasonings that we'll get into as well, that explain that it can be very carefully reasoned out that this is the ultimate reality, this is the final nature of things. Therefore, without entertaining any doubts, even those who wish to attain the enlightenment of the hearers and solitary realizers should meditate on emptiness. So this is what we were already talking about. Because it's required even for their goal, this lesser enlightenment, which we, you know, again, usually refer to just as liberation or mere nirvana, that goal is also dependent upon realizing emptiness. So therefore, they need to meditate on the same wisdom, generate that same wisdom. For the apprehension of true existence is the afflicted ignorance that is the root of cyclic existence, and without repudiating its adhered object, the attainment of liberation is impossible. So last week we went into a little bit of the explanation of what's meant by this adhered object. So I'll try to do this in as brief a way as I can, but I do want to give it enough time so that people sort of understand these various objects. As I said last time, we usually refer to four different objects that are talked about in Awareness and Knowers. However, there is a fifth one that sometimes is talked about too, and in Geshe Rabten's text, did you use Geshe Rabten's, April? It's got that fifth one listed as the fourth, and it's very confusing because it's not really usually in the classical presentation. I'm going to put up the Tibetan in Wiley for those of you who want to know it. Jokyul is our object of engagement. This is called in some texts object of operation. In Geshe Rabten's text, he calls this the principal object. So this is kind of, in all of our cognitions, this is the object in the sense that we're getting at. There's another object, again, this is the one that Geshe Rabten gets a little confusing, which would be the object of observation. Object of observation and the object of engagement can be slightly different. They don't necessarily need to be the same. So for example, we can be observing a flower and be meditating and trying to contemplate the impermanence of the flower. So the object of observation in that case is the flower, but the object of engagement is the impermanence of the flower. Okay? So this is just, it could be a narrower field or some other aspect of the object of observation that we're getting at here in terms of this object of engagement. This is the object that we're really after, in a sense. Everything else has to do with kind of the ways in which consciousness is working with that object, if you will. The second one is zhenyu. And again, this pronunciation isn't going to always work in terms of Wiley, as you know, those of you who've worked with Wiley. Wiley is just a way of transliterating the symbols that are in Tibetan script so that you can then know exactly how it's spelled, because words can sound exactly the same in Tibetan and have very different spellings.
Same spelling can mean a lot of different things, too.
Yeah. This one is usually what we call, and again, Geshe Rabten calls the object of observation the referent object, but we're going to call it referent object. Sometimes this word conceived is here. In our text, this is what's being referred to as an adhered object. It's a strange, I've never really heard that before, this translation, so I'm not sure why they use that word adhered. Zhenyu, referent object, is only used when we talk about a conceptual mind. So again, there are two different types of consciousnesses. One is direct perception, and the other is conceptual mind. They get at their objects very differently. So we've talked about this in the past. We'll come back to Zhenyue, to the referent object, shortly when we get into a demonstration of how these all work in regard to a particular conception or perception. The third object that's usually talked about is Nangyo. This is where you get into the Wiley being different. It's not Snangyo, it's Nangyo. This is the appearing object. So most of you have heard these terms before. Appearing object is called that because it's the object that actually appears to the consciousness. So you might think, well, isn't that the object of engagement? Well, it is for direct perception, but it's not for conceptual mind, because conceptual mind is working with this idea of meaning generality, a generic image of something. And we'll talk about that in a moment, again, go into more detail. The fourth of these objects is Zungyo. It's a B-Z-U-N-G-U-Y-U-L. This is our apprehended object. It's just another way of talking about the object that the consciousness is getting at based on the appearing object. So again, this is more from the standpoint of the consciousness. This is what is appearing to the consciousness. This is what the consciousness is actually apprehending, what it's sort of, in a sense, cognizing, what it's knowing. Again, in some cases, these are going to be, these 1, 3, and 4 are going to be exactly the same. But we'll talk about kind of the variations on this. So, yes, Greg.
So would number 2 also be determined object?
Determined is another word, yeah. That's right. I don't know if I had that on my list. Yeah, I did. Okay. Just putting that up. So let's just talk about a direct perception. So let's say the eye consciousness observing the red of this stand. So again, the object of observation, we could say, is this stand, and then we're narrowing in on the red, and my eye consciousness is knowing directly that color red. The object of engagement then is the red. There is no genuine, there is no determined object, because it's a direct perception. It's not a conceptual mind, it's my eye consciousness, which is a direct perceiver, doesn't work conceptually, knowing that red, observing that red and seeing it. The appearing object, anyone? The red, okay. The apprehended object, the red, okay. So in this unmistaken consciousness that we have that is simply observing the red and eye consciousness, now if there was some other thing going on, it would get a little more complicated, but let's just use, you know, correct consciousnesses, valid cognitions. So this is a valid cognition of an eye consciousness correctly apprehending red. So the red of that stand, again, is the object of engagement, the appearing object, and the apprehended object.
So 1, 3, 4.
Mm-hmm.
Not 2.
There is no 2 in this case, because it's not a conceptual mind. Okay? Now I'm going to think about that red. Okay? So now I'm going to, you know, later on go, someone says, oh, wasn't that a beautiful red on the table? And so I think about that red. What is my object of engagement? The red, okay? So it's still the same object of engagement as that my eye consciousness had. What is this determined object, this conceived object? Also the red. Because again, this is simply saying, what is it that my conceptual mind is getting at, is referring to? Is it, what is it conceiving of? It's getting at the same thing as the object of engagement, that color red that I'm conceiving of, if you will. Again, but my conceptual mind is using this different technique of getting at things. It's not knowing things directly in this case. My conceptual mind is unlike my eye consciousness in that it has an appearing object that is a general image or meaning generality. There's different words for this. It's, why can't I think of the Tibetan? Do you remember the Tibetan? Sorry, I've got it in one of my texts. I'll look it up. I don't know why it's slipping my mind, but...
Isn't that the Tibetan?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that the Tibetan?
No, this is a Tibetan for appearing object. I'm thinking of for meaning generality.
Oh, for generic image.
Generic
image.
I don't
remember.
You know, it's just slipping my mind right now. What this means is that I'm unable to get at red directly with my conceptual mind. My conceptual mind has to sort of, in a sense, take a, it's like a snapshot of it, if you will. It's working with my recollection of red, or even when I'm generating a consciousness, eye consciousness knowing red, once I start thinking about it, I'm not actually using red any longer. I'm using a sort of meaning generality of red. Again, in the Satrantika school, they go through a whole explanation of how the conceptual mind works. The conceptual mind is what we call an eliminative engager. It goes and it kind of eliminates everything that is not red, and that that's left is red. And so it's a process that we do instantaneously like this, but in effect it's quite different than the way in which our sense consciousness is simply open up and take everything in directly. Our mental consciousness that is conceptual uses this meaning generality to get at objects. So this appearing object for a conceptual mind, my conceptual mind that is thinking about the red that I saw earlier, is the appearing object is a meaning generality of red, generic image of red. The apprehended object is going to be the same, because even though I'm getting at my object of engagement, you know, and this conceived object, which is the red that is out there, what I'm actually apprehending, that the mind is actually, you know, directly getting at, is this meaning generality. It's not actually red. Again, this kind of is something that I think takes a little while to work with to really kind of understand. But the conceptual mind has some value in spite of the fact that there's this meaning generality between us and any of these other objects. You know, because it is a means for working with the mind to eventually get at understanding things. So, you know, when we use this conceptual mind and are trying to develop an understanding of emptiness, eventually that conceptual mind falls away and we are capable of realizing emptiness directly. But this artifice, this, you know, way of getting there through using the conceptual mind and this meaning generality is definitely essential in getting to this direct realization. But anyway, yeah, Rowena.
I'm just noting that the only way you can communicate with people is through meaning generalities, unless you're
exactly.
Some sort of, you know, rocking sensual
brain. Well, I mean, you can show them, you know, things for their senses to experience. But in terms of any ideas or any, you know, we have to talk in meaning generalities. You know, we have to use meaning generalities. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm sort of deviating in a sense of looking at how people then take the apprehended objects
mm-hmm.
to be real, particularly because you're sharing that mm-hmm. that meaning generality with somebody else, and that's how a lot mm-hmm. of thinking is usually.
Yeah. Again, and this is what makes a conceptual mind what we call mistaken, is that it thinks that the appearing object is the actual object, but it's only the meaning generality of that object. It's only like it, you know. It would be like looking at a snapshot of the person and thinking it's the person. No, that's a snapshot of the person. It's very different than the person. You know, if you threw the snapshot in the fire, the person wouldn't burn, the snapshot would burn. So there's a very, you know, real difference between what this appearing object is to conceptual mind and what the actual object of engagement is. Yes?
Well, isn't that one of the problems about when we have a relationship with somebody, we're relating to the generic image that we have of them, not them.
Yeah. And then, you know, we get all these other layering, which we're going to talk about shortly, which is the inherent existence of the referent of that, you know. So this is the thing, is that, you know, we're going to talk about how we then are overlaying inherent existence in this whole process on the basis of working with this generic image. And that's going to cause us, you know, that's it says here, that's what we have to get rid of, is this. But let me go into that. Let me see if there's any other questions than we talked about so far. Then we talked about a direct consciousness, a sense consciousness, knowing blue or red or whatever. We have another sense consciousness, or another consciousness, a mental consciousness, this time a conceptual mind that is thinking about red. Two different processes involved. They're both getting at this object of engagement, which is the red, but they're getting at it in different ways. Okay? Now let's talk about this conception of inherent existence or true existence. The conception of true existence is a wrong consciousness. It's more than mistaken. It's also mistaken because it's a conception. But it's a wrong consciousness. What do we mean by a wrong consciousness?
Things don't appear in the way they exist.
Yeah, but moreover, I mean, when we get to kind of the Sotrantika presentation of this in awareness and knowers, a wrong consciousness is said to be a consciousness that is mistaken with regard to its object of engagement. So mistaken with regard to its appearing object, we just call that mistaken consciousness. We call it wrong in terms of the object of engagement.
We don't see that it's empty, we see that it appearing as something with characteristics.
Exactly, with inherent existence and existing from its own side, etc. So, let's start down here, because I think it's a little bit easier if we start down here. What is appearing to this conception of inherent existence or true existence? Let's say we're talking about the conception of that red being truly existent red. So what is appearing to that conception? Yeah, Asha.
Something that's just fixed, not changing.
But in terms of...
Your conceptual thought is that it's...
Okay. But what always appears to a conceptual mind?
Generic
image. But it's a generic image of what?
Of the red.
But of
truly
existent red. Okay. Now, does a generic image of truly existent red exist?
Yes.
Yes. Does truly existent red exist? No. Okay. So, we can talk about these generic images, these meaning generalities, as existence. They do exist, but the object they're getting at, again, doesn't exist. So, the appearing object is a generic image, a meaning generality of truly existent red. The apprehended object is also that, because we're also, again, working with that idea that red is truly existent. It has its own existence from its own side, by its own nature, through its own power, however we want to refer to that. So when we talk about this conceptual mind, what its conceived object is, it's truly existent red. Does truly existent red exist? No. So that's what this is, when we go back to the commentary, it's saying, without repudiating its adhered object, the attainment of liberation is impossible. So without repudiating, meaning denying the existence of this referred referent object, this termined object, conceived object, adhered object, which is truly existent red, we can never undermine this whole conceptual process, because this conception is believing that this exists. Therefore, again, it's also a wrong consciousness, because it thinks it's engaging with a truly existent red. A truly existent red does not exist. Its object of observation in that case would simply be, again, the stand, or the red of the stand, or however we want to call it. But basically, the overlay is happening because of this misconception that we have that thinks that truly existent red actually exists. Yeah, Greg.
So then the difference between a conceptual mind and an inherently existent, truly existent mind, can we posit that?
A truly existent mind. Is there a truly existent mind?
Well, with the other example, the conceptual mind, you gave the example of number 3 and 4 was the meaning of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the meaning of inherent existence, you're giving all 4 of those as the meaning generality.
No, I'm not.
No?
Okay, let me go back over them. These two, appearing object and apprehended object, are the generic image of truly existent red. The object of engagement and the conceived object are truly existent red. Not the generic image of truly existent red. Oh. Truly existent red. So in other words, that's the referent of my conception. My conception is not just mistaken any longer because it's getting at things through a meaning generality, it's also wrong because what it thinks it's getting at through a meaning generality doesn't exist. So whereas in the previous example we were talking about a valid conception, a valid cognition, a conceptual mind that was a valid cognition of red, no overlay of conceptual existence at all. Here we're talking about a mind that has the conception of inherent existence, and that is a wrong consciousness. So that's why, again, these objects will change in terms of now we have a non-existent up here as the referent object and the object of engagement. Because a truly existent red or truly existent person or truly existent anything doesn't exist. So again, this is just a framework to put around how this conception is working. Conceptual minds always work with a generic image, and that makes them mistaken again. But this one is wrong because the object it thinks that it's getting at doesn't exist. Again, we could use an example of a sense consciousness that has a mistaken quality to it. That has a wrong quality to it, wrong consciousness. So a wrong consciousness of an eye consciousness, for example, could be seeing the white snow mountain as blue. So there's certain times of day, you know, when the mountains appear, if you look at them, they appear red or blue or various colors because they're reflecting colors, but that isn't really the color of the snow. If you were there on the mountain and you looked at the snow, it's white. So you've got a wrong consciousness that thinks that its engaged object is a blue snow mountain. Okay? So again, an object of, something that is mistaken with regard to its object of engagement is a wrong consciousness. Something that is mistaken with regard to its appearing object is a mistaken consciousness. We talked about these in the tenets class as well, because there were the various descriptions of those that we had to work with. Anyway, don't feel like you have to get all of this time. This is a sort of preview of what will come when we get to LORIC, to Awareness and Knowers, which, as I said, is just a whole course that where we go in using the Satrantika way of looking at phenomena and analyzing these various types of perception, that will go into an extensive exploration of this idea. What I mostly want to get at today is the fact that when we talk about this conception of true existence, I mean, the main point is what we're saying here in regard to the commentary, is that its referent object, its adhered object, doesn't exist and absolutely must be repudiated for us to ever generate this wisdom that realizes emptiness and for us to attain liberation. So we have to go after truly existent phenomena, a truly existent person, and find out whether they really exist, because we are mistakenly holding them to exist. Okay? Questions? So if we go back to this commentary and just read this last sentence again, it says, "For the apprehension of true existence," so this means our conception of true existence, "is the afflicted ignorance that is the root of cyclic existence." This is our fundamental problem. There's nothing beneath it. There's nothing that is a deeper root. This is it. This is the root. This is where all of it comes from. "And without repudiating its adhered object, the attainment of liberation is impossible." Okay? Now the next verse 54 is that next paragraph. Let's read verse 54 together first. On page 240. "The antidote to the darkness of the afflictive obscurations and obscurations to knowledge is emptiness. Why do those who wish for omniscience quickly not meditate on it?" So on page 241, we'll just go through this. There's probably not a whole lot to say in regard to this commentary. It's pretty straightforward. The antidote to the darkness of the afflictive obscurations and obscurations to knowledge is the wisdom realizing emptiness. So is everyone clear about these two different obscurations? Afflictive obscurations, or sometimes they're called obscurations to liberation, are those that keep us bound in cyclic existence. So this is the conception of inherent existence, its seeds, and all the afflictions that arise from those and their seeds. What we call seeds meaning the potencies that arise in those conceptions again and again and again, and those afflictions again and again and again. The knowledge obscurations, or what we sometimes call obscurations to omniscience, this is said to be what? How is this usually defined or described? Yeah, Janice.
The obstructions to omniscience to being fully enlightened.
But what are they?
They're the imprints of the seeds. There's what the seeds leave. It's the imprint that the seed leaves behind in the mental consciousness, like garlic in a jar. The garlic is the seed. You take that out, but the jar still smells like garlic. That's the imprint of the obstruction.
Right.
Omniscience.
Good. So we can talk about these imprints that come from having conceived of inherent existence again and again, having maintained those seeds in our continuum. All these imprints reside in our mind. They're a very subtle obscuration. They give rise to, because these imprints don't just sit there, they also have their own effect. Their effect is dualistic appearance and the appearance of inherent existence. So this is what has to be removed in order to attain omniscience. So whereas for just mere liberation, all we have to get rid of is this misconception that we have and everything that's built on it and all the seeds of it, in order to get become omniscient, in order to have sort of the barriers completely broken down so that we can know all phenomena at all time, we have to get rid of this dualistic appearance of subject and object and the inherent existence that appears as well. Even though we don't conceive of it any longer, there still will be an appearance of inherent existence. All this needs to be gotten rid of, and that arises through the force of these imprints. So we can talk about the obscurations to knowledge being these imprints, as well as the dualistic appearance that arises from those imprints. Okay? So what it's saying here again is that the antidote to all of that darkness, what keeps us obscured from liberation, what keeps us obscured from omniscience, is the wisdom realizing emptiness. We talked about this earlier. Hence, why do those who wish for omniscience, in which the two obscurations have been extinguished, quickly not meditate on that emptiness? So it's like, if this is what you want, is to attain omniscience, then get on your cushion and meditate on emptiness. What are you waiting for? These are layers, again, what's at the heart of it is obviously this imprint. We're not going to actually be able to remove the obscurations to knowledge until we've gone through all those layers and removed all of that. And we're not going to be able to remove all of that until we've trimmed down the affliction somewhat through our own taming of our minds and, you know, more temporary ways. But, you know, it's all part of the process, all the work that we need to do. So separated from it, meaning the meditation on emptiness, separated from realizing emptiness, one will not be able to even abandon the seeds of the afflictive obscurations. The seeds of obscurations to knowledge are the final imprints of afflictions, whereas manifest obscurations to knowledge are the factors of appearance in which things appear truly existent and so forth. So this is what I was just explaining. So we can talk about, you know, these obscurations to knowledge, the seeds of those are these imprints of the afflictions. And when it's manifest, when it ripens into these imprints give rise to their result, it causes us to have this appearance of true existence, which again has a dualistic quality to it, and a truly existent object and the subject that is perceiving that. So it's said that even bodhisattvas who have attained the eighth ground through the tenth ground. So again, if you go back to your little chart of the grounds, the first through seventh grounds are where the bodhisattva removes all these obscurations to liberation, the afflictive obscurations. That bodhisattva is then liberated in a sense. They've attained a nirvana, but they keep going. Why? Because they want to attain omniscience. It's said that for that eighth ground, ninth ground, tenth ground bodhisattva, when they are not in meditative equipoise on emptiness, there is the appearance of inherent existence. They no longer would even have the seeds of the conception of it. They don't even have any buying into it. But it's a false way that things appear. They still haven't cut through all of the obscurations. Those are what keep us, again, from attaining, you know, complete omniscience. So the imprints that are on the consciousness, as well as this arising of those imprints into this effect, this result of dualistic appearance, the appearance of inherent existence, are what keeps us from being a Buddha. However, it is inappropriate to take the following stand. Whatever appears as truly existent is necessarily an obscuration to knowledge, and so forth. So my teacher, when he taught on this in the commentary I'm using from him, didn't really explain this, but does anyone have any idea what this is? What is it that we would say is an obscuration or is an appearance of true existence, but is not an obscuration to knowledge? Just one of these weird little points that I'll share with all of you, and you can, you know, tell others at cocktail parties and what have you. What is it that is an appearance of true existence that is not an obscuration to knowledge? What this has to do with, I think, and this is, again, I have to qualify that because my teacher didn't talk about it in his commentary, but what I believe he's referring to is the fact that for the mind of a Buddha, we can talk about the mind of a Buddha very... We can try to talk about it, but we can talk about it as having two qualities, if you will. The mind of a Buddha no longer variates between, you know, realizing emptiness at one point and then going back to some sort of conventional reality of, you know, seeing the other truths. The mind of a Buddha knows the two truths simultaneously. So it's quite clear how a Buddha knows ultimate truth, right? Because the Buddha is in meditative equipoise on emptiness all the time. Now, how does a Buddha know the conventional truths, the conventional phenomena that in the end exist only nominally?
Through our eyes.
Through the eyes of and the minds of beings who are together with delusion, are together with that appearance of inherent existence. So when it comes down to it, there really is no, quote, real object that a Buddha's mind is knowing. It's only knowing that object via the deluded, the mistaken mind that is getting at these objects through this dualistic appearance. So let's just talk about, okay, like, you know, again, I've got a little bell ringer in my hand here. For all of us, I assume, in the room, maybe some of you are Buddhas and I don't know it, but we have this together with an appearance of inherent existence. So we have active times when we're conceiving it to inherently exist as bell ringer from its own side, with its own power, under its own power. But regardless of whether we're thinking of it in that way, it's always appearing to inherently exist. These imprints are ripening in, it's having this feeling of its own substantial existence, its own entity, from its own side. This is part of our dualistic appearance. And even when we get rid of our conception of inherent existence, this is still there. So a Buddha's mind isn't together with that appearance of inherent existence anymore. They've completely gotten rid of it. So the only way for them to know anything that we designate as bell ringer and appears as inherently existent at bell ringer to us is through the deluded minds of beings that are together with that ignorance, together with that imprint, at least, if not the full ignorance that misconceives it as inherently existent, at least the imprint that causes it to appear as inherently existent. So those appearances to the minds of ordinary beings are how Buddha knows what we call conventional phenomena, because there is no inherently existent conventional phenomena to know. There is only this appearance of inherent existence, because in the end we don't find the phenomena through this analysis that we're going to go through, these reasonings that we go through. We don't find an inherently existent bell ringer. Does that kind of make sense? I mean, again, if you want to read more about this whole process, I'd recommend The Two Truths. We got one or two copies of this in the library, at least one. There's a whole chapter on omniscience, which is, I find, quite fascinating, because it is quite difficult to talk about the mind of a Buddha. But most of the Gelugpa scholars feel that this is the way in which we can posit that a Buddha knows the two truths, is by knowing conventional truth only through, well, primarily through the minds of sentient beings. There are some conventional truths that the Buddha does know in other ways, but I'm not going to go there tonight. You can read this, because there are pure and impure conventionalities.
Is that something that was spelled out in the scriptures, or is that something that scholars have concluded?
It's mostly scholars, yeah. Let me read you one sentence. This is page 198 of this book, if you're interested in looking at it later. It says, Buddhists see impure conventionalities, which are what you and I, everyone, you know, sort of deals with, not as their own appearances, but only by way of the appearance of such conventionalities to minds polluted by ignorance. Okay? So how they see certain pure conventionalities, for example, I mean, we talk about the Buddha's having the 32 marks and the 80 signs, you know, these various things that are manifestations of the Buddha having attained all these qualities and what have you. These sorts of things are known by a Buddha's wisdom not only because they appear to minds affected by ignorance, but also as spontaneous effects of a Buddha's eons of practice as a bodhisattva. So it's like there's a karmic ripening of that appearance being able to happen to them through the force of what they've done on the path, through creating this pure, uncontaminated karma. But we also could still say that there is some positing of them because they also appear to the minds of those polluted by ignorance in some regard. Anyway, sorry to entertain you with these strange little concepts, but I think they're kind of fun. Does anybody have any questions on that? So that's what we mean here, where we say, okay, there is an appearance of true existence, which is this bell ringer appearing to my mind as truly existent, which therefore a Buddha can get at what bell ringer is, because that appearance of a truly existent bell ringer is happening to my deluded consciousness, my polluted consciousness. But that isn't an obscuration to omniscience for that Buddha. I mean, that Buddha doesn't have any obscurations to omniscience. And yet there still is an appearance of inherent existence involved in the conception of that object by a Buddha. Anyway, that's my guess as to what's going on there. If anyone wants to entertain any other ideas, in this book too, A Dose of Emptiness, there's a bit more about this as well. But anyway, you're welcome to take a look at these during the break if you want. Any questions on that? Let's go ahead with verse 55. So we're at the top of page 241 now. If terror will be generated from the thing which produces suffering, then why generate fear with respect to that which pacifies suffering, emptiness? So this, right in the middle of this page, where it says, in summary, this is related to verse 55. So somebody might object here, and they say, well, you know, that may be all fine, but I'm not going to meditate on emptiness because it scares the hell out of me, basically. So due to terror for the meaning of emptiness, one should not meditate on it. And there actually are, you know, these stories of, like, when Lama Tsongkhapa was teaching on emptiness, supposedly one of the monks in the audience who was hearing these teachings got this realization and grabbed at his robes, like, you know, I'm going out of existence. This is a good sign. This means that you're touching on the object of negation. You're really getting at this misconception that we have that there is a real self. Dare I use those words? Rinpoche uses those words. You know, but we do talk about still that there is a conventionally real self, but it exists only nominally. So when we understand that truly, that there is no referent object of this misconception, that this truly existent self does not exist, some terror can arise. You know, some fear can arise. The response is, though, you know, hey, but you have your fear generated at the wrong thing. If it is appropriate to generate fear and terror with respect to the principal producer of the suffering of cyclic existence, our apprehension of true existence, then why generate fear with respect to that which pacifies the suffering of cyclic existence, the wisdom realizing emptiness? So it's saying, you know, you may have some, you know, misgivings about what it takes to realize emptiness, but you have absolutely nothing to fear, because what you're fearing is that which gets rid of all your fears, because all your fears are being generated in regard to this apprehension of true existence. In other words, we wouldn't fear anything if we really understood how the self existed. All of our fear is built up on this misapprehension of the self. Oh, what a relief it is. Yeah, I mean, if we, and this is again what we talked about before in this class, is that we can see how strong our understanding of emptiness is to the extent which, to which it starts to get rid of our afflictions and our fears and all these things in our life. If we're finding that our realization of emptiness isn't having any effect on that, we're probably not realizing emptiness deeply enough yet, or correctly enough perhaps. This is why, again, a lot of time is spent by Lama Tsongkhapa to delineating exactly what this object of negation is, exactly what that referent object is, so that we are very clear when we start hitting on it what we're getting rid of, what it is that we're negating. We're not negating too much, we're not negating too little. We got it just right. Okay, so we'll talk more about that as well tonight. But this, as this commentary concludes, is this fear is inappropriate because that wisdom realizing emptiness extinguishes fear. When you understand the true nature of selflessness, you will be freed from all fear. Okay, let's read the last verse in this section. If some self existed, then one will fear anything whatsoever. But since no such self exists, who becomes afraid? So again, this is kind of throwing it into that, you know. Who is it that is fearing? Who is it that, you know, you're protecting? You know. So this last paragraph in this commentary, it talks about this verse. It says, if some inherently established self existed, then, due to adhering to it, it's reasonable that one will generate fear towards any object whatsoever. So, you know, if it existed the way that we think it does, if this referent object did actually exist, then there would be cause for fear, because, you know, you are talking about inherently existent self that gets inherently existently annihilated, and whatever you want to, you know, however you want to label that whole process. You know, but this, as it says here, but since no such inherently established self exists, even in the slightest, as Rinpoche always says, there's not even an atom of inherent existence, not even an atom. Maybe you could go smaller in like a quark or something, you know, now. All these like little
photons.
You know, so who is it that becomes afraid? I mean, I think when we really contemplate this, this is why I think Lama Yeshe was really quite keen. We do talk about these two extremes that you can fall into, negating too much and then falling into some, you know, extreme of annihilation, or negating too little and falling into what we call the extreme of permanence, which means you're still got some inherent existence you're holding on to. Lama Yeshe used to tell people, you know, head for the annihilation door, you know, just negate it all, because we don't have a tendency to do that at all. You know, our nihilistic tendency isn't so great. Our permanent tendency is quite strong. You know, we're really, really grasping to things existing inherently. All you have to do is kind of go to the edge of this and just bring yourself back a little bit. You know, you won't fall into that extreme of nihilism so easily, I think. But if you, you know, again, the way Rinpoche puts it is, it's almost as if it doesn't exist. And when you think about it, I mean, if we're just talking about nominal existence, that means just merely designated, nothing more, not a hair more than being merely conceived. That's it. Totally operational and functional in spite of that. Don't get me wrong. I mean, again, that's nihilism. That's falling into, yeah, and then there is no self, so nothing matters, and there's no...
That's
yeah.
Just depression, isn't it?
I don't know. I suppose. I heard a comedian once do the, maybe it's not even related, but it came to mind. She said, do you know the difference between depression and boredom? Depression is, oh my God, I'm going to die. Boredom is, what am I going to do until then?
I really like that. Anyway, I thought it was kind of Buddhist in a way, but I don't think she meant it to be Buddhist.
I actually have a question.
Sure.
It might go back to another verse, but it's just in my mind. I'm thinking about the little children who are tested because they think they're the candidate who's the reincarnated Lama.
Right.
So if we can postulate somewhat realized being, when they look at a bell, Dorje, whatever it is,
right,
there's a myriad of them on the table, but they know which is theirs. What is that? Are they just saying they recognize it, or does it have inherent existence?
Well, but again, we wouldn't. What? Let's go back and say, you know, is there anything about it, merely looking at its conventional existence, that, you know, say again, we'll use the example of the 14th Dalai Lama, the malas and the, you know, whatever objects that he used, that they mixed up with these other objects that he didn't use. And most of you know that this is the way in which they determine some of these incarnate lamas, you know, is by putting these objects, a bunch of them together, and the young tulku will pick out the one that was theirs from a previous life. If conventionally we say there was this conventionally existent mala that was conventionally designated as the 13th Dalai Lama's, that now is designated as the 14th, and it's this, there's some continuum of that object. I mean, we're not denying that. I mean, I'm just trying to get in. If we frame it simply in conventional terms, why does it need inherent existence in order to be the previous lamas that's now being identified by the young tulku as his? Do you see what I'm saying? I don't know that there's anything in that particular dilemma that gets at the problem of misconception of inherent existence, or it needing to have inherent existence to be designated as the 13th Dalai Lama's that is now being identified by the 14th Dalai Lama as having been his when he was the 13th Dalai Lama. You see what I'm saying? I don't know if I see in that example something that would, that brings, if we're misconceiving it as inherently existent, then that's a whole other layer of problems. But in terms of just conventional existence, we do this all the time. You know, we go out to the parking lot after this teaching and we can very clearly find our car.
Oh, no.
You know, I hope. You know, and that car is a continuation of the bits and pieces, again, that are all merely designated, that are calling it, you know, we call it our car. We designate it as our car, and it functions as our car, and we have the key for our car. And all of these things play a role. They completely function within the soup of lacking inherent existence. But there's still a continuity of them. So that whether we're talking about a continuity from life to life, or whether we're talking about a continuity from moment to moment, or whether we're talking about mental continuity of mental moments from the previous Dalai Lama's mind to this mind, these are all completely possible. But they're just not possible as inherently existent moments of mind or inherently existent objects. Do you see what I'm saying?
It is interesting that they use objects, however, for purported realized beings.
Maybe this is a very skillful way for them to do something that we can all conventionally get behind. You know, if they were to try to get at mental realizations or other things that, you know, we don't have any way of assessing, then they would have no ground in conventional reality and the sort of the workings of the world. It's an interesting point. Yeah, Rowena.
It isn't the object that has any inherent existence, but the mind will have habits, just like you will have a habitual ability to recognize your car. I mean, those imprints are there.
Yeah.
So it's in the mind of the Dalai Lama. It's not the object. It's nothing to do with the mala at all. It's just he's able to recognize something he's seen before because he's still young. I mean, the Dalai Lama says after about age 4, I started forgetting what was going on before. It's considered fairly normal that even non-realized children will sometimes, there's a lot of stories about it. But that's their minds. It's not the inherent value of the mala. It's just the habit. I mean, if you pick up something, I had an experience with this almost totally blind woman who was my godmother as a small child. Mm. When I was a small child, and she'd been in the home, she hadn't seen me for years. But she somehow figured out who I was by my voice, because she'd seen me as a teenager right from class. This was like 8 years ago I last saw her. When she took my hand, we might as well have been 50 years ago. Mm. It was something about just the feel. She knew exactly who I was, and all these other people kept coming and going in the room, and she still knew who I was, and she couldn't see us. It was just a real interesting thing, because there's a whole bunch of sensory stuff that you, as a body, you have to do. And so the memory was in our hands, not in our eyes, not in anything else. Yeah.
Good.
Well, the word continuity helped. And your story, too. So, thank you.
Sure. Let's take a little break, about 10 minutes or so. You can have tea, cookies, what have you, and then we'll come back and continue in our perusal of the wisdom of emptiness. Okay, any questions before we start the next section? Okay. So now what we're going to do, we're, like I said, heading into the meat of the chapter. If you go back to the very beginning, when we started this, the initial sort of outlines that we worked with, we saw that there was an explanation of the text, and we got into kind of these various topics. We're under the main topic of method for generating wisdom, so we're actually kind of getting into, you know, in detail how we're going to generate this realization of emptiness. So it starts with, as you'll see on page 241, dividing this into two different sets of reasonings. And this is the way that it's normally presented in the Mahayana, is the reasonings on a refutation of a self of persons, so that these prove selflessness of persons, and the reasonings that prove selflessness of phenomena. Well, we just went through a whole bunch of stuff that said there's no difference in these selflessnesses. They're both the lack of inherent existence. So why do you need a separate reasoning to realize the lack of inherent existence of a person and the lack of inherent existence of phenomena? What's that all about? Does anyone know?
Is it easier to get rid of one first before the other?
Yeah. So we've touched on this briefly before, this idea that it's actually said, though, even though the generation of these misconceptions is exactly opposite, we first misconceive phenomena to inherently exist, and then we misconceive the person. The actual way to undermine those conceptions is to first realize the selflessness of persons, and then realize the selflessness of phenomena. So why is it more familiar, or why is it better for us to start with the person as a basis? Yeah, I there's some texts that actually say this, yeah, that we're sort of closest to that. But there's also, I went back to my teacher's commentary when we studied Madhyamakavatara, the supplement to the Middle Way by Chandrakirti. And in that text as well, they present... Well, actually, no, that's not true. In that text, they present the selflessness of phenomena first and then selflessness of persons. But they make, in Lama Tsongkhapa's commentary, he makes it quite clear that the selflessness of persons is realized first. And let me read you what my teacher said in regard to that. He says, in his middling stages of the path, which is the next text that we're going to study here, Lama Tsongkhapa says that from the point of view of the production of the two conceptions, the conception of a self of persons and the conception of a self of phenomena, first a conception of a self of phenomena is produced, then a conception of a self of persons. Whereas from the point of view of realizing the two selflessnesses, the selflessness of persons and the selflessness of phenomena, one first realizes the selflessness of persons and then the selflessness of phenomena. Lama Tsongkhapa says that they are realized in this order because it is easier to identify the substratum of the selflessness of persons than to identify the substratum of the selflessness of phenomena. Why is this? When the person is realized, what is realized? When the person is realized, it's realized to depend upon the aggregates. So when we think of person, you know, think of any person, think of yourself, you think of it in ways that are quite obviously dependent upon the aggregates. I mean, what person can we talk about without talking about Carly's body or Carly's mind or some component of that that is the basis for a person? There's the idea of Carly only comes up in regard to that basis. So for each one of us, it's quite clear when we think about it for even a short period of time that there's a very strong dependency and interrelationship between person and aggregates that is much more there than the way we look at other phenomena. You know, in the lower schools, know that they have this idea that the person is an imputed existent to some extent, not in the same way that we mean in this highest school. We mean that in the way that they also consider other things to be imputed existence, like a forest is imputed on the basis of many trees. So forest, I mean, where you don't find forest without finding a bunch of individual trees. You don't find army without finding a bunch of soldiers. Army and forest are collective kind of ideas that are placed on the enumeration of many of these things coming together. In the same way, they say person is an imputed existent, in that same type of vein. Not saying that there is no person, there's just a person that kind of arises in relationship to there being components or parts of a person. They're not at the point where they're denying that that person has any inherent existence. They're just denying that there's a substantial existence, if you will. Because they believe that there is substantial existence. They think that the trees are quite substantially existent, but the forest is an idea of a bunch of those trees coming together. Whereas, you know, person is kind of also an idea of a bunch of things coming together. The aggregates, the mental and physical aggregates. So again, they don't go so far as to say it's merely imputed, that there is nothing in the end that really is the person. They only go so far as to say this is a mode of existence of person that we're misconceiving. We think the person has substantial existence when really there's only imputed existence. So this concept, I think, again, is a little bit easier to work with, and that's why person as a basis to realize emptiness is already kind of getting you in that direction of seeing there being some nature to person that isn't quite the same as its basis. You know, forest is a bit different than trees. It kind of arises on the basis of trees, but it's a concept in regard to that. Let me continue with what my teacher said. He said, understanding the person to be dependent on the aggregates, one understands that the person is not independent, and that the person is merely imputed by an imputing conception. And he goes on to talk a little bit about kind of the lower school thing, but just know that, again, this is why it's said to be, you know, easier to work with the person. Many texts refer to it in that way. But I've also heard, again, that there is this idea that the person as a basis for realizing emptiness is also quite good because we're quite familiar with it. We work with it all the time. You know, analyzing other phenomena, we don't have a direct experience of them as much as we have an awareness that's with us almost all the time of the person. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I don't know, but what makes it easier for me, if I have the emptiness, but take myself with a grain of salt, is to see that how frequently I'll react differently to the same phenomena. You know, I mean, somebody will say something 1 minute, they can say exactly the same thing the next minute. I'll be upset 1 minute and not the next, or vice versa, depending on where I am, you know, 20 minutes down the road. I mean, that gives me a hint, at least, that I'm a bit inconsistent,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, if we really kind of analyze these reasons, these experiences, we see that they point to the fact that there is no inherently existent self.
Either that or that self's crazy.
Or both.
It's a relief. It's a relief to sort of study this because the crazy parts.
So in this text, Shantideva follows the sort of traditional way and presents the selflessness of persons first. You'll see that in this next section, then, he goes into this extensive explanation, beginning with refuting what we call the adhered object of the innate apprehension of the selflessness of persons. Okay, so we're going to explain what that means. There's a rather lengthy explanation, actually, of what that means. But we can definitely delineate that there are two levels of misconception that are as a part of our ignorance. What we call the innate means inborn. It means this is what's been going on since beginningless time. So you don't have to newly construct this conception. You were born with it. you came into this life with it, and you had it in the previous life, and you came into that life with it, and you had it in the previous life, and you came into that life with it. It's innate. It doesn't mean that it's inherent to the mind. Again, this is not how we hold this ignorance. This ignorance is not an inherent part of the mind. It's adventitious, but it still is innate. It's there because we continue to conceive of things to inherently exist, and that continues to plant the seeds. This innate conception is fed by our active conception of inherent existence, but it goes on from life to life. There is another piece of our misconceptions of the self that are acquired, and we can have various levels of that too that we're going to talk about. So that's why this next section, section 2 of your outline, goes into the acquired apprehensions of a self, of persons, and how that selflessness is established in regard to that referent object. And then we go into a final section that dispels any objections regarding what we've refuted. So the actual verses that refute the innate apprehension are quite small, and we're not going to read them yet because we go into some commentary that precedes the real commentary on these verses. So let's start on page 242 with going through some of this, what I call kind of the prelude to the actual refutation. So with respect to this subject, it says, the difference between acquired and innate apprehension of the self is as follows. An awareness generated spontaneously, without relying on having engaged in the analysis of reasoning, that apprehends inherent existence and existence by way of its own character. You know, those are synonyms, by the way. That's not two different things. Regardless of whether one observes person or aggregates. So person, we know what that is. Aggregates is phenomena other than persons. Which exists in all, meaning all beings, those whose minds have been transformed by tenets and those who have not, is called the innate apprehension of true existence. So this is saying that whether you've gotten, you know, screwy tenets in this life by, you know, misunderstanding things through something you acquired philosophically, or whether you've just been born into this life and never gone through that process, you have the innate apprehension of a truly existent self of phenomena, self of persons. Yes, Greg.
So where it says aggregates there, should it say
no, I mean, when we usually kind of talk about that, we say, because actually if we talk about it technically, aggregates doesn't include all phenomena other than persons either, because it's only, aggregates are all impermanent phenomena. Usually when we kind of get into this delineation of person and aggregates, we're talking about either the person, which is quite clear what we're talking about, the person that is imputed on the basis of the aggregates, or the aggregates, the basis of designation for the person. And when we talk about, like we're going to get into some verses from Nagarjuna, he says basically, actually I don't know if that's in this section, but in Nagarjuna's Precious Garland, he says that, you know, without, that if you don't remove the apprehension of the aggregates as inherently existent, you don't remove the apprehension of the person as inherently existent. In other words, it's the same lack of inherent existence. It's just that one often acts, again, as I was saying earlier, there's usually, yeah, and there's usually the, as I was just reading from the commentary from my teacher, we first adhere to the aggregates as inherently existent, then we adhere to the person that's designated on the basis of that those aggregates as inherently existent, and we do these quite quickly, you know. So if you see, for example, you know, you're out hiking and you see the body of, you know, somebody walking through the trail up ahead of you through the woods, you've seen and gotten in touch with, you know, aggregates first, their body.
The inherently existent aggregates.
And then you hold that they're inherently existent, and then you impute a person on the basis of those aggregates, because you're not, like, you know, no longer noticing it just as thinking it's shadows or the tree or something. You think that it's real aggregates, it's a real body, therefore it's a real person. We don't ever impute real person before we impute real aggregates. That's why they say the conception of inherently existent aggregates comes before, or phenomena comes before inherently existent person. But again, we remove them in the opposite direction. Because again, there's already that bit of a process. This is what we're really getting at, that kind of process that goes on. That person is dependent upon the aggregates. What person can we talk about without talking about the aggregates? You know, quite logically, quite commonly, this is how we think. We're going to see some of these schools, these non-Buddhist schools, think that there's a person that is apart from the aggregates. Even in, you know, Judeo-Christian theology, they say that there is a soul that is some entity that is apart from the aggregates. It has an existence apart from the aggregates. And it's different than your mind, and it's different than your body. It's similar to the way these non-Buddhists adhere to some self that has an independent existence. Of course, Buddhism would say this certainly isn't innate. This is absolutely acquired. We're going to get into that as well. But here we're just defining the innate. This is the inborn conception that all of us have, whether we studied bad tenets or not, that there is an inherently existent self of phenomena or of persons. Yeah,
it's
Janice.
It's what we share with animals.
Yeah.
That's how I remember it.
Yeah.
Animals and us, innate. You know, they're born clinging to a reality that they think is truly existent.
Yeah.
All beings,
you know, all beings in all the realms. You know, we don't have any direct experience of hell beings in their minds because they're not sharing this realm with us, but they all have this innate apprehension of true existence. This is the ignorance that's carried, again, from life to life and just is at the root of all of our problems. Not that we, again, are going to totally neglect the acquired elements of it. We do have to get rid of that as well, because that's another layering on top. Let's read the next bit that talks about the acquired. The conception thinking true existence is tenable, and it is truly existent, in reliance on having engaged in the analysis of reasoning, although also an apprehension of true existence, is the acquired. So in this context, what we're only going to talk about is the acquired misconception of true existence. There are other acquired, and there are other innate, for that matter, misconceptions of the self. But here we're limiting our discussion to the root problem, the misconception of true existence. We all know what the innate is, we just went through that. Here what it's explaining is what's acquired. This is acquired only through the force of reasoning, only through the force of our actually taking to mind this idea of whether things are truly existent or not. So if you were, you know, going through this class and doing these reasonings, and you came to the conclusion that there is a truly existent self, and adhered to that and continued to believe in that, while that's totally consistent with your regular apprehension of true existence, it's acquired, because you acquired it through the force of reasoning. Your reasoning wasn't very effective because the reasoning is supposed to refute inherent existence, and it ended up strengthening inherent existence. So you ended up generating some conception of it. Again, in all the other tenets of Buddhism, we could say that all of them could at some point go through that process of acquiring a conception of true existence. If a Prasangika came in the room and a Satantrika was there, they might, you know, challenge them in regard to their belief in inherent existence. And based on the Satantrika point of view, they might not be able to refute that. They might actually strengthen their view that things inherently exist. They truly exist. That level of misconception is what we would call acquired misconception of inherent existence. So anything that is developed through the force of reasoning and false tenets, you know, all the influences that we have on us that causes us to have that conception that things inherently exist, that's acquired. The fundamental ignorance that's always there regardless of whether we've had that influence of tenets or not, that's innate. Again, all we're talking about here is this misconception of inherent existence. As I said, there are many levels of misconception that we could talk about, and we're going to get into those shortly. Okay, everybody's still with me. I know we're getting to the end of the class, so it's always challenging. Let's go to the next paragraph. Although the apprehension of the self of persons can be included within the innate apprehension of self-sufficient substantial existence, the apprehension of the person and the aggregates is being... Okay, so let's just stop there. That first part. So we can say that there is an apprehension of a self of persons. Again, as I was saying, all we talked about so far was a truly existent person. There's also this misconception that all the lower schools, you know, we've discussed this one before, again and again, the misconception of a self, of persons, that is a person that's substantially existent, self-sufficient. As we said, that was what all the other schools say is our fundamental problem that keeps us bound in cyclic existence, is misconceiving the person in that way. So this first part of the sentence is saying, although, yeah, we could say that there is this misconception of a self of persons that's included within the innate apprehension of self-sufficient, substantial, existent person. Again, because we can talk about that as also being innate. So we all do carry forward not just this misconception of a truly existent person, but also the misconception of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Is everybody kind of getting that? Again, these are, according to Prasangika, consequence school, these are respectively the subtle misconception of a self, which is an inherently existent self, and the coarse misconception of a self, which is a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. In regard to the person, we have both of those conceptions innately. So they can both be acquired as well through the force of false tenets and reasoning, but innately, from life to life, we carry forward some coarser idea of a self, a person existing self-sufficiently. What does that mean? Does everyone recall what that means? Janice?
If someone can exist self, that means you can perceive the object without perceiving any of their aggregates.
Okay. So there's some independent status of that person. Right. Not so much independent that it's completely removed from it. Again, Jeffrey Hopkins uses this analogy for that type of a person as kind of like a head salesman and the people in that sales department. So the head salesman is a salesman as well. I mean, there's all the salesmen and there's the head salesman. It's kind of a, you know, somebody who's in charge but is kind of among them but independent of them. We can still talk about them in an independent way. You know, there's the sales department and there's the head salesman that runs the sales department. This is somewhat different than what we're going to see in the latter part of the sentence, which is a master and servant, or, you know, lord and its subjects. There we got two different strata. You know, this is the lord up here and the subjects down here. In the other one, we've got the head salesman and the salesman. They're all kind of a part of the same department, whereas the lord and its subjects are totally removed, independent in a more substantial way, if you will.
So there's more segregation with the king and the subjects versus mm-hmm. the sales department, where it's more integrated.
Yeah. In a sense, I mean, so we still kind of, again, it can appear to us independent of the aggregates, but it doesn't have its own sort of independent existence, if you will. It's a strange, I admit, these misconceptions of a self, I find it really easy to talk about an inherently existent self. I find it really hard to talk about some of the other ones. But we have this innate apprehension of the self existing in that self-sufficient way, having its own sort of self-sufficiency. Again, that one is very similar to what I was just talking about in terms of this person that is designated to the aggregates, but, you know, is in the same way like a forest is designated to a bunch of trees. It doesn't have any sort of substantial existence, but we misconceive that it does. We misconceive that there's something substantially there that is the self, that is the person. And these get kind of confusing because, again, we're going to use similar terminology when we get to refuting inherent existence. But the rest of the sentence is basically saying that that's that even coarser misconception that I was just talking about, this really independent self that we call this permanent, unitary self, this is that same idea that we were just talking about of like a soul, or in the Hindu tradition, it's Atman. This Atman that has a completely independent existence, that is the person away from the aggregates, and actually that's their liberation, is recognizing that the person is a part of this other essence and not in any way a part of the mental and physical aggregates. That independent aspect of a person, as it says here, is only acquired, that apprehension. So this sentence, let's go through the first part again. Although the apprehension of the self of persons can be included, it sounds weird to say be included within. Maybe it's more like, I don't know the Tibetan, but the idea here is that the innate apprehension of self-sufficient substantial existence is also included within the apprehension of a self of persons. However, the apprehension of the person and the aggregates as being like a master and his servants, meaning this permanent, independent, unitary self that is the self and the aggregates being the servants of that self, should be known as being solely the acquired. So you don't get the idea that the person exists as a soul or Atman or anything without acquiring it through tenets. You're not naturally born into this life or into any life thinking that the person has that type of existence. Whereas you are born into this life thinking that the person's inherently existent and thinking that the person is self-sufficient, substantially existent. That's the gist of all of this. It's taking a while to go through. These are pretty heavy-duty concepts, but yeah.
So you said like one of the main ways of studying consciousness is, I mean, I guess it's saying that you first start off with the selflessness of the person. At the same time, can you try and work with the conceptual mind as well to study? I mean, obviously, it's two different ways of that.
Well, we're going to use the conceptual mind absolutely as our framework for getting at the realization of the selflessness and use it to help us eventually bridge the gap to this non-conceptual awareness that realizes emptiness or selflessness of persons and of phenomena. But absolutely, the conceptual mind and using the conceptual mind is key in all of this process. Is that what you were getting at? I misunderstood.
Example, you know how you're studying like the concept of color and
right.
The referent object and these.
Uh-huh.
You know, that seems like that's one way of.
Like the conceptual process,
yeah, the conceptual
as opposed
process
to
and
okay.
How it kind of conceives things inherently. And yet, the actual object itself is not inherent. I know that's one way of kind of getting, you know, emptiness across. And then there's also another way of doing it where it's like examining the selflessness of the person.
Because
Shanti Dev is saying in this part, the best way to do it is to start off with the selflessness of the person.
Well, I think if in the end we have to rely on reasoning to get us there regardless. So we can understand how conceptual mind works and this whole process and the various objects and how it's misconceiving objects. But in the end, we have to engage in some sort of reasoning to refute what this process is believing in. You know, so again, we go back to that phrase that, you know, we have to repudiate the adhered object. We have to deny that this exists. And the only structure, according to the Gelugpas, there's no like instant realization of emptiness. According to the Gelugpas, in the Prasangika tradition, basically, you have to go in and reason through and say, you know, in the same way that if you, and we're going to use this analogy, if you were trying to find a thief in a house, first you have to know what the thief looks like. You have to know what you're looking for so that you don't misidentify the thief. Then you have to delineate, where can I look for the thief? What are the possible places where this thief could be? And then you go looking. And if you don't find the thief in any of the places that you said it was going to be, that you thought it was going to be, there's no thief. You were misconceiving a thief in the first place.
Right, so it does tie in.
Yeah. I mean, it's good to understand the structure of it and everything, but in the end, we have to rely upon reasoning. And the reasoning proving the selflessness of persons is said to be, you know, best to realize first, because we can already see this, I don't know, kind of shakiness to person as being more of a concept than a concrete thing. Not that we're already there and, you know, conceiving it to not inherently exist, just that we've already got kind of a toehold in it, you know, a little bit, you know, more ground. Yeah. Okay. Let's just go through this last little bit. Well, it's not a little bit, but maybe to the break in the page there, and then we'll stop for tonight. So it said again that misconception of a permanent unit. Again, this is what we call the misconception of a permanent, unitary, independent self. That's the one that's like a master, and the aggregates are the servants of that. And this is, again, that idea of an Atman or a soul, some sort of independent entity. In the same vein, the apprehension of particles as partless, that comes from our Vaibhashika and lower tenet systems that say that there's partless particles. In other words, you get to these very minuscule particles that you can't say there's a top and a bottom and an east and a west. And total fabrication. You know, there is no such thing. How could a partless particle ever have contact with another particle when it doesn't have a part that it could have it contact with the other particle? So this is a misconception that is acquired. And consciousness is partless, is also acquired. Like there is, we get to a point where there's this, you know, partless moment of consciousness, that this is in some way, you know, established. This is all acquired. And those are acquired apprehensions of the self of phenomena, meaning they're misconceiving how phenomena, the moments of consciousness and particles of material, matter, exist. In brief, the two apprehensions of the self that are generated spontaneously without relying on the analysis of tenets are the innate, whereas apprehensions of the self other than them are the acquired. What are the two? We just went through two paragraphs. One dealt with the innate apprehension of a self as what? Truly existent. The other is the innate apprehension of the self as self-sufficient, substantially existent. So these two apprehensions of the self that are generated spontaneously without relying on the analysis of tenets are the innate. Everyone in this room, again, if you're not a Buddha, or at least if you're, I mean, maybe you could be a foe destroyer and then you would have gotten rid of these two, but basically if you have a ordinary deluded mind together with ignorance, polluted with ignorance, you have these two innate apprehensions of the self. You are born into this life thinking that the self exists, that the person exists inherently and self-sufficient, substantially existent. Whereas apprehensions of the self other than them, meaning any other view of the self you want to have, I mean, you might view the self in some highfalutin way that, you know, we haven't even thought of yet, some new, you know, I don't know, I remember, I don't know where I got this from. When I was younger, somebody was talking about this idea of, maybe it was one of these philosophers that thought that we were all just brains in a pan. Did you ever hear this idea? That there's like somewhere that they're having this experiment where we're all just these brains in a pan. It's like a matrix sort of thing where they're stimulating, you know, our brains to have these various experiences. And that's the reality that we're all experiencing is, you know, our brains being stimulated in a pan somewhere. And if you want to think that's what the self is, you know, those are acquired, though. You don't naturally think that that's what your life is about or what you are as a person is some brain in a pan off in some other realm. Yeah. Yeah. Kurt Vonnegut stories, too, I think, yeah.
God's own man with his control.
Yeah. I always think about the Vonnegut novel with the Sirens of Titan, where like we're all just the entire human race was created in order to get a part made that they needed to get their spaceship fixed or something, and you know it was quicker to do that than to, you know, get the part sent from where these people came from that are living on, you know, Saturn. It was really strange. Like, I got to the end of it and I was like, going, boy, that's a really, really out there concept. Poor Kurt. He had some strange ideas, but. So that's basically, again, anything else that we layer on as to what a self is, a person is, that's all acquired. We don't naturally have those conceptions. Although the adhered objects of the former being these two innate misconceptions, are the main objects of refutation, understand that the refutation of the objects of refutation of the latter is a branch of the refutation of the former. In other words, we're going to refute these other sort of acquired misconceptions of a self in the process of refuting those innate ones. You know, you have to kind of, again, these are sort of like layers of onion or something, and we come in with these innate ones that are the core of it, but then we layer on top of it other misconceptions that we learn. You know, so when I was in, you know, Roman Catholic catechism and, you know, hear all this stuff about a soul and all this. These were acquired misconceptions that were being layered on top of it. You know, for me to kind of get to these other layers, I'm going to have to cut through those misconceptions as well and refute them in the face of all the other things that I'm, you know, reasoning through. So, okay. We didn't make it as far as I was hoping, but that's okay. So there's no handouts tonight. If those of you who weren't here the last class, I did pass out the quizzes for this section that goes up through verse 59. So you're welcome to get those. I have those here. Maybe I can just pass them around now. Again, they've already been collated, so all you need to do is just take two sheets. If you don't have these, it's, again, it's quiz 7 and the answers to quiz 7. Yeah, Carly, just take the bottom sheet. They're collated into two sheets, so yeah. So you just take the top two sheets. Yeah.
Oh.
That's it. It's my weird way of doing things. Sorry, I end up kind of messing up for everybody. I should just go
is
back to.
Is that innate or acquired?
It's acquired. Okay. Any questions? I really
continue teaching this.
Next Wednesday we're having another class.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Now there's one more class that I was intending to actually get up through verse 77, and it's obvious that I'm not going to. But we're just going to continue through because even though I don't even think we're really advertising this as a start of another course, because there's nobody outside of the people who've been coming here, I think, that are going to be able to sort of just walk right in the middle of chapter 9. Maybe there are, but we won't be doing, we'll just continue with this. So next Wednesday, which is the 7th?
Yeah.
Next Wednesday, the 7th, we'll meet. We'll kind of more formally start the last of these courses on Shantideva that deals with verses 78 forward a little bit later. I'll just keep going through this until we get done with 77, and then we'll go forward. So classes will start again, I guess, the Wednesday after Rabina's Wednesday night, so that'll be the 19th. And we'll just keep going till the end of the year at least, and if we don't finish then thanks, Greg, then we'll figure out what we're doing at the beginning of the year. Right now we are really I'm hoping that I can finish this. I'm really wanting to make sure we take our time and digest it as well as we can. The other thing, though, is what I keep, you know, reminding people of, which is that as with any of these studies, particularly this type of in-depth study of emptiness, it takes several times doing this to really, you know, get it to begin to, you know, where you recognize the words and the language that it's being used and the concepts that are being thrown around. And so be patient with that, you know, and recognize that the nights that you walk out of here and feel like you didn't get anything, that's perfectly fine, because you're just planting seeds to eventually get something out of it. So I can't tell you how many teachings on emptiness I've sat through, so this is, you know, a slow process, but one that the patience will reward you, certainly. So, okay. Let's say our prayers. Let's go to page, I think we've got, maybe let's go to 246. I don't want to keep people here too late. So before we recite these dedication verses that are from the 10th chapter of Shantideva's text, you can bring to mind specifically some individuals that you want to dedicate for, bringing to mind those who are experiencing obstacles in their life, those who are experiencing illness, who are dying, who have died. Whatever beings you want to bring to mind who are experiencing the sufferings of samsara, think very strongly that you're dedicating all this positive potential to the relief of their suffering, both temporally and ultimately, finally, dedicating very strongly for your own enlightenment so that you can help them to have that final relief from all dissatisfaction and suffering. And then we generate that mind wishing for the welfare of all beings by reciting these verses together. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Turn back one page on 244. We'll recite the long life prayers for His Holiness, followed by this little prayer. I think all of you have this little on a sheet prayer that spontaneously fulfills all wishes. And then we'll recite the long life prayer for Lama Zopa. So as I've said many times before, think that you're not just creating the causes for the good health and long life of these two very precious teachers, but you're also creating the causes for the good health and long life of all spiritual teachers with whom you have a karmic connection, so that you might never be separated from them nor from the precious Mahayana Dharma that they teach in this lifetime and all lifetimes until you attain the state of perfect, complete enlightenment. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snowland teachings and transmigratory beings, who makes extremely clear the path that is unification of emptiness and compassion, to the lotus holder Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And lastly, dedicate for peace, peace in the hearts and minds of each and every being throughout each and every realm, just sending that out in all directions. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Such a precious opportunity to work with this text.